Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Where Geoffrey Lehman makes, I think, his fourth address to the Sydney Institute. He spoke variously on the unusual combination of taxation on some occasions and poetry on other occasions. Geoffrey Lehman's poetry was first published in the London Magazine when he was 18, and his first book of poetry, which he wrote poems along with those of Les Murray, won the Grace Levin Prize for Poetry in 1965. In 1981, his new poem, Nero's Poems, again won this prize, and in 1994, his Spring Forest, published by Faber and Faber, was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. He has co-edited three anthologies of Australian poetry with Robert Gray, and their book, Australian Poetry Since 1788, was included in The Economist Best Books for 2011, and Geoffrey and Robert spoke to the Institute on that book a few years ago. As many of you know, Geoffrey Lehman's a lawyer by training. He's been a partner of an international accounting firm and co-author of five editions of a major taxation text. And as well as that, he's been chairman of the Australian Tax Research Foundation. The good news is he's not talking about tax tonight. He's talking about poetry, about science and poetry, on the occasion of the publication of his most recent collected works called Geoffrey Lehman Poems, 1957 to 2013. Geoffrey Lehman, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. And thank you for coming along tonight, dodging in and out amongst the lightning bolts. I've got a speech here which I'll read. I've called it Poetry and Science and the Future, and the subtitle of it is Making the World Intelligible. Measured by telescopes, our universe began 13.8 billion years ago. Cosmologically speaking, that is yesterday. If all life expectancies of all people alive today were added up, this is about 45 billion years, more than three times the age of our particular universe. Light has been detected from objects that are now 46 billion light years away. There are at least 100 billion galaxies, and each galaxy typically has thousands of millions of stars. We live in a young universe that changes rapidly and whose physical laws are barely comprehensible. My earliest memory is of my family gathering downstairs in the dark as explosions sounded across Sydney Harbour. I've only recently realised this must have been the Japanese submarine attack in 1942. I was not yet two. Charles Simic was born in Yugoslavia in 1938, and his earliest memory is of bombs falling in Belgrade in 1941. Simic came to New York in 1954, but soon discovered when he began writing poetry he was an American poet. He felt unable to play at being a European poet with the religious, cultural and historical baggage this concept carried. Writing in the New York Review of Books of 14 August 2014, he explained, quote, that each poet renders the world intelligible and in so doing determines its nature is an idea of Wallace Stevens that is widely shared by American poets. Emerson asks in his famous essay Nature why Americans shouldn't also enjoy an original relation to the universe and have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition. That's the end of the Charles Simic quote. I go on to say, the core of poetry is that it is a way of making the world intelligible. This doesn't mean a poem has to be intelligible any more than a piece of music has to have a meaning. The poetry of John Ashbery, an American now in his 80s and regarded by many as the leading contemporary poet writing in English, is notoriously opaque. But that opacity or absence of intelligibility itself may be a meaning or feeling he is trying to convey. Opacity, even as genial as Ashbery's, is a high-risk strategy for poet. Readers lack intelligibility, and the lack of intelligibility of much modern poetry has turned many readers away. I myself am on the side of intelligibility. Starting in 1954, I had a marvellous English teacher for 3 years. Pat Eldershaw was a 5'8", corpulent man in his late 50s, with small purple veins in his red cheeks. He had a dry, sceptical manner and a broad Australian nasal twang, as he'd grown up in the bush. He introduced us to modern American and English poetry, T.S. Eliot, Auden, E. Cummings. These were poets who had something to say, and their subject matter was urban and contemporary, unlike the poets I'd previously encountered, such as Shelley and Banjo Paterson, whose subject matter and language were alien to a 1950s schoolboy. Pat also introduced us to the poetry of William Blake. He showed how a poem such as Blake's The Sick Rose was not just about a rose. It was about the corrupting effect of organised religion and conventional morality on our natural spontaneity. Not a marvellous thing to be teaching in a CV school, but that's what we're... Well, poetry, I felt, was the mystery of everything, and my role in life was to become a poet. In my second last year of school in 1955, entranced by studying Book 4 of Virgil's great pastoral poem, The Georgics, I formed the ambition of one day writing Australian pastoral poems. How a city boy with no experience of the bush might do this was unclear. I studied arts and law at Sydney University. I decided I wanted to be an Australian poet, the same way that Simic wanted to be an American poet. And to do that, I had to remain in Australia. I may have hankered to retain a certain naivety and provincialism, and perhaps have an Australian relation to the universe. Between the ages of 15 and 30, I wrote hundreds of poems reflecting many different influences and styles. The monologue, speaking through the voice of a historical figure, I found was a liberating style, like assuming a mask, as in ancient Greek drama or Japanese no theatre. Poets don't write poems. Poems write themselves. When I was about 30, my predilection for monologues took my poetry in two very different directions. I began writing through the voice of the Emperor Nero. I didn't anticipate that I would be writing through his voice for another 30 years. At about the same time, I also began to write the Spring Forest poems through the voice of an Australian farmer, Ross McInerney, who was then my father-in-law. I had no idea I would continue writing through Ross's voice for another 40 years, long after he ceased to be my father-in-law, and until his death in 2010. Steven Pinker, in his The Better Angels of Our Nature, states that of the 49 Roman emperors reigning before the division of the empire, 34 were killed by guards, high officials, or family members. When Nero, just 30 years old, begged his servant to stab him, he is recorded as saying, "Qualis artifex perio, what an artist dies with me." He was supreme ruler of the ancient world, but personally an anarchist, libertarian, sceptic, anti-establishment, and contemptuous of senators who represented the Roman elite. And above all, in his own mind, he was an artist. Like many artists, he was an extremophile. Those little bugs that live near those hot things at the bottom of the sea. He went on operatic singing tours, playing the hydraulic organ, was a charioteer, roamed the streets of Rome with gangs at night, was a matricide, an enthusiastic bisexual, and carefully composed written judgments in difficult legal cases late at night. I felt I had to record all of Nero's polymorphous, perverse persona. But how to do this? Poems have to emerge from something in one's own experience. One night, my first wife and I went to dine with friends in North Sydney. The parking spot near their house was across the other side of Anderson Park. Rather than follow the road around, we walked across the park, a decision we soon regretted as we found we were among solitary figures patrolling and clicking their fingers, and from time to time entering and exiting a public toilet. It was unnerving and menacing, but we couldn't retrace our steps. We were told when we got to our friend's house that a few days earlier a stranger covered with blood knocked on their door begging for help. They had telephoned for an ambulance. This experience provided the material for one of Nero's poems, On the Beat. Down on the beachfront at night, savage hands drag me into the shadows. Each time I ask, do they bring joy or a knife? The savage hands make me lean against the brickwork, gasping. They could strip me, rob me, stab me. I wouldn't care. But I know they feel as I do. We know each other by signals, fingers clicking. On the beachfront at night, I go to meet my black god, who holds my life in his hands. Like the hydraulic organ he loved to play, I found I could do so many different things through Nero's voice. It is easy for celebratory poems to become stodgy. Aqueducts, a celebratory poem spoken through Nero's voice, begins. The moon, an aqueduct, water power for our mills. But Rome is miles from here. In this brown field, beside the road, my urine spills. Steam rises from dead grass. While young men touch themselves in lodging rooms, and thieves hide in your stripes of shadow, and voyeurs watch behind a screen of trembling leaves, this utilitarian dream on arches high above the city never stops. It regulates itself on humid days when meat and cheese are rank in shops, a torrent cold as ferns. So that's just a part of aqueducts. Addressing his new empress, Poppaea, Nero, my Nero, begins another long celebratory poem, Gardens, in this way. Because she coveted his garden, my mother had a man accused. Strolled through our costly real estate with me, Poppaea, our guilt excused by daisies growing from cracked stonework. A lot of houses also had to be demolished to build a garden. Nero's persona gives both poems attention and edge. I once thought about writing a poem cycled through the voice of Pliny Jr., another Roman garden lover, but there would have been no tension. Pliny was too decent a sort of chap. I was able to make Nero's gardens a political statement. Until Nero, it seems, Roman gardens hid behind walls, mainly in courtyards. His great palace, the Golden House, which he nicknamed the Shack, may be the first open-plan palace, an ancient Versailles. I have him say, as he walks through his garden with his empress, we can pull down our walls of fear, an unwalled city's open space, with vineyards by our blocks of flat, we'll halt our spectacles of blood. Our unemployed will raise their hens and lettuces from city mud. Great parks will liberate our poor. Grasshoppers click across ploughed fields as we advance, hands linked and talk. Courtyard gardens hide and enclose. Exposed to sun and wind we walk and look back at our golden house, the colonnades of a long stage, where we are gods on public view. Gardeners will spell in topiary box your name and mine, my love for you as obvious as this bank of poppies. Nero's poems is a political essay. The contradictory elements in his personality, a corrupt idealist, a libertarian and absolutist, a pacifist and man of violence, a lover of high art and vulgarity, these are a mirror of the tensions in his society. Is our society all that different? Ross McInerney was a great raconteur and observer. He had hundreds of stories. Preserving these stories was the trigger for the Spring Forest poems written through his voice. You will realise, of course, they also fulfilled the dream of my 15-year-old self, inspired by Virgil's example to write Australian poems. And this meant I didn't have to buy a country property either to write pastoral poems. By writing through the voice of a person I knew, I had to strip my language back. And the voice that emerged was disconcerting, sparer and more laconic than anything I had written or imagined. Here is the opening Spring Forest poem, which was written after I'd become accustomed to this voice that was neither mine nor Ross McInerney's. Getting started. When we first came, our house was two weatherboard rooms and a bare paddock. I was just back from a war. There were no trees, and I chose the name Spring Forest. It was dark when we drove up and lit our pressure lamps and unpacked. Our children found potatoes sprouting on a wire mattress on a large iron bed. What were they doing there? My daughter kept asking. We burned iron bark in the old brick fireplace, rubbing etherized hands into warmth. At dawn, Sally and Peter were out, calling in the frost, exploring. A long icicle hung from the tank. That day, five cars passed on the road, and the children ran out every time. I've sometimes thought it was a strange thing, in fact intrusive, to write poetry through the voice of a living person. A couple of weeks before Ross died, I drove up to visit him in Karra District Hospital. He was very ill, and it took a while for our conversation to get started. By the time his next-door neighbour, a farmer, arrived, Ross had become quite animated. "I want to introduce you to Jeff," he told his visitor. Referring to his daughter, Sally, my former wife, he said, "When Sally was at university, she rang up one day and said, 'Is it all right if I bring up a friend next weekend? I thought it would be another girlfriend, but it was Jeff. I was really surprised." Laughter. This is Ross. He and David Campbell were my favourite Australian poets. This was an astonishing piece of information, that he had read my poetry before we met. It was suddenly clear to me why he'd been so tolerant about the Spring Forest poems and their sporadic inaccuracies, which he never mentioned. This new Ross-like voice allowed me to include direct commentary in poems. Ross was a passionate conservationist and had his Spring Forest property declared a wildlife refuge. So I wrote about the environment. In the following poem, Ross's Spring Forest morphs into the Spring Forest, a symbol and emblem of a primeval world, the Spring Forest. Each year, we get further away from the Spring Forest, the original text. Drinking straws, we say, sipping a milkshake of imitation vanilla through a thin plastic tube. My children in summer used stubble from paddocks for sipping crushed strawberry water. These days, you don't find tadpoles boiled up in the washing. Each year, there are more gaps in the text. Privet in creek beds chokes out she-oak. Weeds blot the lettering. Each place spoke through its plants and fauna until we came. For most of my life, I have fretted about overpopulation. It's not that we're about to run out of resources. Humans are too inventive for that. The problem is our numbers are crowding out the other species. It is a moral and not an economic issue. The Animals is a recent Spring Forest poem. The Animals. A domesticated bearded dragon, $400, is not my idea of an animal companion. A calf asleep on a double bed, perhaps, or a hare with long ears crouched under a mahogany sideboard, thumping the floor. Or a koala that climbed up a four-poster bed, surprising a 17-year-old in her 90. They were here before us, the animals, and we were once them. Without understanding, we watched the sunrise and the coming of night, registered the changing of seasons and dew on leaves that brushed our flanks. We, the animals, knew feelings, had a memory, exchanged sounds and visual cues, but didn't know what came before or ask what was to come. A neighbour sleeps with a wombat in a bed, and her husband sleeps on the veranda. Kangaroos watch TV through a sitting room window. Bottle-fed joeys get osteoporosis if the composition of the milk isn't right. The females make better companions. With shy brown eyes, they hop along beside you as you collect mail from the gate at dusk. We were once them, and now are their custodians. They know we are different, and their eyes tell us to keep our promise. Bill came home after a fortnight away. Pot plants had been kicked off the veranda. There was an awful smell, and the front door was ajar. Inside the house, chairs were overturned, papers and cushions trampled on floors, and in the bathroom, wedged against the wash basin, her putrid flesh held together by hard twinkle, a pony, a tractor winched the body out. When this poem was published in the New Yorker, pot plants was changed at the last minute to potted plants to avoid confusing an American audience. All of that's true. Bill and his children actually appreciated the particular poem. It helped them to live with the stench, which was continuing for some months. The voice in the Spring Forest poems allowed me to speculate about science as an enthusiastic amateur. I have no science training. The Golden Wall. Don't ask Uncle Pat why the night sky is dark. In hot weather, taking his mattress out on the grass inside his dog-proof fence to sleep, when Pat lifts his face up to the night propped on a pillow of capok stuffed in mattress ticking, he'd fix you with sheep drench if you told him that his line of sight should intersect at every point with a near or distant star glimmering in the transparency of space, so the whole sky should be ablaze from end to end like a golden wall. Pat's golden wall was his orange tree. Like Uncle Pat, it had never borne fruit until I dumped 5 tons of chicken manure on its roots. His line of sight from the cane lounge where he sprawled intersected at every point with oranges 20 feet up in the sky, a utopia of fruit which the district came to visit and eat, oranges with no ending, like the return veranda around the four sides of his house where nephews and nieces ran forever and their children after them. Pat forgot his promise to pay for the manure, and the oranges didn't come back, but he didn't miss them. So don't ask Pat why the night sky is dark. Aubert's riddle has hung around for centuries. You can't explain it by absorption. Gas and dust heat up and glow, nor by absences or voids. Each square inch has its galaxies. Ask the cells inside your head the same riddle. Why don't they all blaze at once, a golden wall of noise, each neuron singing its own note, deafening your mind with light? Political and religious visionaries promise us this, each cell singing in unison, a mass of indistinguishable stars. But something in the universe denies the golden wall. Some structure which became Uncle Pat calling to his nephews from his cane lounge, "Don't trample them tomahawk plants," meaning hollyhock plants. Pat prefers his own company on hot nights, leaving Auntie Bridge inside with pictures of saints on the bedroom wall. He takes his bedding and lies in a darkness where each star can broadcast as a soloist. The universe is a composition of unique bodies on display, and the night sky of the mind allows a single file of thoughts to light up as a sentence. The accelerating expansion of the universe suggests to some cosmologists it will end in entropy. As space stretches out, galaxies will become invisible to each other and fade. No one will be left to observe particles and radiation evenly and thinly smudged across a flat and endlessly expanding near vacuum. This journey from a dimensionless point, the Big Bang, to universal entropy is a bleak Thomas Hardy view. The physicist Freeman Dyson points out, however, in A Many Coloured Glass, page 76, what we see in the real universe is the opposite of heat death. We see the universe growing more ordered and more lively as it grows older. A simple thought experiment suggests why entropy as the end of everything may be wrong. We cannot imagine a moment when time began. There will always be an earlier time. It is counterintuitive that there has been only one Big Bang just 13.8 billion years ago. Why then and not before? If entropy is the end of everything, and there has been only one Big Bang, It should have run its course already. We should already have come and gone an infinite time ago. Our universe seems to repeat itself and create its own observers. They may have a variety of shapes and attributes, but intelligent life requires communities, and communities will have an ethical sense like us. If this is so, our universe is not just a display of stupendous forces and likes that annihilates itself. These universes evolve rapidly out of matter and forces so concentrated they erase all information about their predecessors. There has always been a universe or universes, and there is no beginning or end. In Breakfast with the Black Snake, which is part of the Spring Forest sequence series, two parents on a country property discover their two-year-old child with white hair like straw is vanishing mysteriously each morning. They follow him one day, spying on him, and watch him drag a saucer of milk in a paddock. Waiting to see what happens becomes unbearable for the mother, who snatches him up. The parents' guess about the meaning of these events can never be verified. The white-haired boy was Peter Taylor, mayor of Toowoomba from 2008 until 2012. Breakfast with a Black Snake. All we have is circumstantial evidence. A two-year-old with white hair like straw, one of three brothers, vanishes each morning, and one day, spying parents follow at a distance, he crawls across a paddock, dragging a saucer of milk, and sits in the grass and waits. But not for long. A scolding mother snatches him up, too young to explain or remember. All we have is circumstantial evidence of a child's conjectured breakfasts with a black snake. If fate is entropy and time has no beginning, why are we still here? All we have is circumstantial evidence. The universe repeats itself. The repeating universe, which annihilates all trace of itself before starting again, was imagined by Hindu theology and perhaps Heraclitus, who saw the world as an ever-living fire with measures of its kindling and measures going out. It doesn't have a meaning or intention in a human sense, but its self-organizing principle of repeated growth and annihilation is replicated in its details. Like the fractal numbers of a Mandelbrot set, at the smaller scale of our individual lives, there is a self-similarity to the repeating universe in our birth from a single cell, our rapid growth in complexity, and our death. When I visited Ross McInerney's farm Spring Forest each Christmas, I was struck by the brutality of the Australian summer. It was hard to believe the devastated countryside could ever come back to life after this death by heat. But it does. I wrote about this circle of birth and erasure of information in Water From My Face, through Ross's voice. Water From My Face. Each year, spring occurs with such vehemence it's clear the plants don't remember last summer's dried sticks. The young discover their bodies as no one before ever did. The old say we remember and forget. Nature has no memory or imagination. The water falling from my face into a rusted enamel dish washing under a Karajong tree doesn't recall its shape for long. In one of the very last Spring Forest farms, I imagine Ross in his late 80s driving at dusk, unlicensed, much to the alarm of his family. He used to drive around unlicensed and gave him the heebie-jeebies, and stopping to observe the sky and experience for a moment an original relation to the universe. This is the last time I read. Driving at dusk. I'm driving with just my parking lights. I switch off the motor in the dimness under a large ironbark and can hear a distant sound of dogs barking like the monotheisms of the Middle East. A water cannon sends a pulse of spray to drinking fields. There's a pale yellow sky fading into blue, and the first stars of a universe, free of meaning, lucid and uncreated, signed by itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Geoffrey. So Janet Grundy's got copies of Geoffrey Lehman poems 1957 to 2013, and she's got one copy of the anthology Australian Poetry since 1788, in which Robert Grave features, a new feature, and many others. And so we've got till about the top of the hour. I think the earliest poem you've got in here, is, as I recall, is 1957, isn't
that right? Yes, yes.
17. Tell me, how do you do it? I mean, I've spent a lot of time walking around North Sydney. I've never been propositioned and never felt the need to write a poem about it. And I contrast you with Les Murray, because you'd write your poems and go back to work the next day, you know, writing legal letters. Les, I think, has been a full-time poet pretty well all his life. So how do you do what you do, and how does he do what he does? I mean, where do you find the time to write all this and get these experiences, or is he having a soft life up there?
Les, I think he's a wonderful poet, for one thing. You know, I greatly admire his poetry, and I admire the fact that he decided to be a full-time poet. That was not for me. I wanted to get married and have children, and so I thought, well, I've got to support them. So I became a lawyer and eventually became a tax lawyer after spending 10 years teaching at the University of New South Wales. I wrote a huge amount of poetry when I was young, and then when I got older I didn't need to write so much poetry, to the extent that when I was writing a couple of poems a year and I'd be working at PricewaterhouseCoopers, if a poem arrived then I would write it, whatever the situation was, but I felt that that was okay when I was working back late, and in any event that only happened once or twice a year. Strangely enough, I started to write a fair bit more poetry in my 60s than I had for some years. So I had this sort of late burst, which I was very grateful for, and it was a complete surprise. But as I said, poems write themselves. You have no real control over them. You can direct them to a degree, and you can train yourself. I train myself by writing just hundreds of poems in fixed forms and rhyme and this type of thing. I really only discovered how to scan properly. I was able to scan Latin poetry before I could scan English poetry properly, which was an odd thing. But what happened was I went along to a lecture by James Macaulay and at the Sydney University, and he pointed out that the typical English da-da, 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 the iambic pentameter. You occasionally breached it by going da-did, da-da, 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 and that these subtle changes in stress, where you in fact breach the stress, was what gave fixed form its interest, which free verse couldn't have, because if you're writing in free verse, you weren't grappling with anything. You couldn't surprise, because freedom doesn't surprise, whereas breaking with rules does. So I heard this lecture by Macaulay. A couple of months later I sent him a poem when he was at that stage the editor of Quadrant, and I cunningly put my phone number up in the right hand corner of my covering letter. So he gave me a ring and asked me to come and see him, and then gave me exactly the same lecture which I'd heard a couple of months before. And I thought I couldn't interrupt him. So that's how I learned how to scan. And so the poems that I wrote, supposedly in fixed form, but they weren't really in fixed form at all. They're a terrible mess rhythmically, before I heard how to properly scan from James Macaulay, quite different from the poems that I wrote afterwards.
So your language is Latin and what, German, right?
A bit of French as well.
A bit of French. So, Robert.
Geoffrey, you know what I'm interested in. And what you say about poems writing themselves is what Lawrence also believes. That, in fact, he had a name for the creature, whatever it was, that wrote his his work. He called it his daemon. Do you have a daemon?
If I met my daemon, I wouldn't recognise him or her. But certainly poems do write themselves. And for example, I could not have written about politics in the way that I did in the Nero's poems, essentially a political essay about the conflict between, I suppose, liberalism and conservatism is really at the heart of those poems. I could not have written those through my own voice. Similarly, I found that once I had the voice of Ross McInerney, I could write an actual scientific argument. The poem about Olbers Riddle is actually actually contains a lot of argument. To do that in my own voice, I couldn't do that. So that, for me, writing through different voices is a way of expressing things, and perhaps those voices are one's demon or diamond, however one pronounces it.
So we go here and then we go to Anne, yeah? Yes.
Is it possible, not comparing you, but to say that Barry Humphreys does the same thing with his characters? He can't say it himself, but Dame Edna will say something that is inside Barry.
Yes, I think that's very fair. I think Barry's actually a very good poet. A few years ago when we put him in that anthology, there was one poem of his that I wanted to put in, but I didn't want to put in the last verse. So I got in contact with him, and we know each other very slightly. So I suggested the new title. I had to change the title very slightly and get his consent. So we sat down one afternoon in his flat down in the Key Building, and he had his copy of Neglected Poems and I had my copy of Neglected Poems. And we went through and he agreed on the change I was suggesting, and then he told me various other changes that he had. So he's a poet as well as a speaker through voices, and those voices are part of him and yet not part of him.
So what was the problem with the story about the last verse?
It was a poem about opening an art exhibition, and it was just too much piece of vers d'occasion, whereas the occasional verse. So that's why we had to leave it out, because you couldn't put a poem about opening an art exhibition in an anthology like that. Well, that's what I felt anyway. He agreed.
Jeffrey, you say you wrote the political stuff through Nero's voice because you couldn't have said it in your voice. And I go back to James McCauley, and James McCauley's earlier poetry seems to be much more intellectual than some of his later poetry, which is much more pastoral and simplified. Do you see yourself moving through different moments in the way you've been inspired to write your poems? Have you changed in any way?
I think one does change a great deal. But there is one sequence in this book, the so-called simple sonnets. There are 14 of them because there are 14 lines in a sonnet. But in fact, I've written probably about 30 of the simple sonnets, but I wanted to keep it at just 14. And the first one wrote itself when I was 18, and the last one wrote itself when I was 72. And I wrote a couple more after that. I couldn't stop writing them. But in terms of the style, they're fairly indistinguishable. You wouldn't know that one was written by an 18-year-old and the other was written by a 72-year-old. The style has remained unchanged over that period. But certainly one does change. I'm ashamed of a lot of the early verse I wrote and published and revised a lot of it. Oh, it's just silly.
I sort of wondered, were you trying to be too intellectually smart, or were you not using your own voice?
No. Poets write a huge amount of stuff. This is how you learn how to write. And you write a lot of things that are really stupid.
But some of it was good enough for Robert Hughes to plagiarise, wasn't it?
No, he didn't plagiarise anything I wrote. I don't think he would have been at all interested.
But someone else was.
I've not ever been plagiarised, as far as I'm aware.
Who did he plagiarise?
He plagiarised an English poet called Terence Tiller, a winner of the Nobel Prize called George Severus, and various other people.
Didn't do him any harm. No, yeah, Anthony.
Just an interesting point, and you also wrote through your own voice, and I'm thinking in particular you were lucky that you did enjoy your professional life. It was not just a job to earn money. Because I remember you had a poem which started something like, you're talking about bringing your son into the office one day, and it starts off, if memory serves, "At 62, I enjoy what I do." And I thought, God, you're a lucky fella.
It then goes on to say, minus a prostate, I have erectile dysfunction.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I remember that.
Yes.
It all goes downhill from there.
Anyone want to improve the tone somewhat? There we go. Just speak up a bit.
For your poems, there's one called The Hidden. You're actually my favourite Australian poet. What you said earlier about when you were reading Shelley in the 50s, he was alien to you. How do you feel about him these days? And about traditional style poetry in general?
Shelley's written some wonderful poems, but I still don't really like Ode to the West Wind, which I got when I was about 12 very much. There's a wonderful little parody of it in the Bulletin, which was about polar bears. They used to cruelly have polar bears in Taronga Zoo at one stage, and it's about these polar bears looking at themselves reflected in the water, their ice facsimile. And the last line of it is, "When winter comes, he springs a fur behind." When winter comes, can spring be far behind? But Shelley wrote some wonderful poems. Although he made some very silly statements like "Poets of the Legislators of the World" and things like that. But there are some wonderful poems by Shelley. Banjo Paterson, I think now, is a wonderful poet, and we put a lot of him in this anthology. And even his slight poems, "The Animals That Noah Forgot," is some wonderful poems about animals there. And he was a fantastic poet, really. He pretended not to be a poet. He said, "Oh, look, I'm just a versifier," but I think he was underrating himself.
Down the back? Yeah.
Jeffrey, do any of your poems escape from your own religious view and political views? I just detected in your readings a particular point of view. Does that colour your poems, or do you move out of that comfort zone?
So the question is, do any of your poems...
Exactly a question. I mean, are any of your poems approving of a belief in God, for example?
Okay. Do any of your poems escape your religious and political views, is the question.
Right. Well, when I was 9 years old, I went to a church school... church being preparatory school, Mossman originally, and I just found going into chapel rather depressing. And so one day I was in my father's house, and I was looking up at the cloud wondering whether it would go across the sun or not, and I said to myself, "Oh, if it goes across the sun, there's a God, or there isn't a God," I can't remember which. I didn't even bother watching whether it went across or not. I decided there wasn't a God, end of story. So I've been an atheist since a very young age, and I haven't changed. But my German grandfather built the first Anglican mission station in New Guinea, as they used to call it then, in 1891, and came back to Sydney and died of malaria the day after he got back. So I wrote a long poem about him and that mission, in which obviously I don't, it's not anti-religious. And I just a few months ago, I went on an Anglican pilgrimage up to the site which he was at in 1891. And what happened was that he built a little native chapel with the help of the natives there. And corner pole of the native chapel was a mandawa tree. It's a pole of mandawa wood, that is rosewood. And this pole grew roots and leaves. And the original chapel has now disappeared. But there is this huge tree standing there looking out over the sea with the mountains behind. And a vast cathedral, a Romanesque cathedral, which is white with a red roof, bigger than St Andrew's Cathedral. And you can only get to this place by going in a dinghy with a motor at the back of the dinghy, of course, 3 hours up the coast. So that was a very exciting experience. But I wrote the poem a long time ago, and any Christian could be relax with that poem, and I got on very well with everybody on the pilgrimage. They knew that I was an atheist, but I sort of took part in the Eucharist without actually praying or anything like that. I've actually got a poem written through the voice of the Borgia poet, Borgia Pope, Pope Alexander VI, which is in an anthology of Australian religious verse, but it is a pretty obscene poem, although it was put in an anthology of religious verse.
He's a pretty obscene pope, wasn't he?
Probably.
Right, here, Deborah.
I was just going to ask Jeff whether there is a wonderful poem in that book, Why I Write Poetry, I think it's called. And I wonder if you could read it.
Yes, I'd be happy to read it.
Just for the podcast, the request was that Jeffrey read the poem Why I Write Poetry.
Why I Write Poetry for Pat Ellershaw, that's the English master I mentioned, 50 years late. But I was able to give it a copy of this poem to Pat Ellershaw's son, John, who was the president of the Shore Old Boys Union at the time and was 80 years old at the time. I was able to give him this poem about his father. Why I Write Poetry, Pat Ellershaw, 50 years later. In my childhood, dead poets have a habit of making unexpected appearances. I'm 5. We've moved to a skinny house by the harbour. As the last crates are carried in at dusk, blue gas rings burn in a darkened kitchen. This is the house where the poet Henry Kendall lived, my father says in his sententious voice, reserved for important announcements. I'm 8. A radio voice is saying, a Melbourne publican, Joshua Mooney, used to light the fire in his saloon with the IOUs of poets, Adam Lindsay Gordon, Marcus Clarke. My mother blushes with excitement. That was my grandfather, and when he was an alderman, he named the streets of St Kilda after the poets. So an Irish-born publican left a roadmap of English verse circa 1870. Milton intersects with Browning and Tennyson streets. Chaucer curves into Wordsworth. And he didn't forget Shakespeare, Spenser, Cooper or Sully. I'm 10. We move to a house among tall trees. Magpies steal my hair. I make friends with a small old lady weeding her stone ball. The poet Louise Mack used to live in your house. It seems everywhere my child eyes look, poets are growing like wild lupins. But that's not why I write poetry. At 13, my mind is made up. I'll be an artist. But what sort of artist? It's like sitting a multiple choice exam. Singing with my mother, I can't hear notes she hears. I'm not a natural draftsman, and fiction's too hard. Where are the stories? Poetry is my default option. But that's not why I write poetry. I despise it at first. I don't hero here Shelley's West Wind. My lifelong love affair is prompted by a 5'8", 60-year-old man, a first-rate cricket coach with silver hair, purple cheeks, small brown eyes, and sarcastic nasal twang, who carries his rotund body as though he's wheeling a neatly stacked trolley. In his acid Australian bush accent, he asks 30 boys, "Is there anyone here who isn't absolutely certain there's a life after death?" I'm the only hand raised. He gives us to read, poems to read, Blake Elliott, E. Cummings, Crow Ransom. He analyses, asks questions, doesn't enthuse, observing quietly, letting us decide. Poems are detective stories with hidden meanings. Our honours group meets after school in his study, surrounded by the bleached jackets of Lawrence Sheep, Virginia Woolf and Joyce. A smoky sun goes down and lights of buildings and boats tremble on cross-hatched harbour waters. Our voices recently broken, we inhale the printed word. Poetry, the mystery of everything. A boy puts up his hand. "Sir, I've just thought of a terrific image. Red sails in the sunset." "Jackson, you've been beaten to it." His name was actually Simon Lee, but I couldn't call him Lee because that's sometimes a Christian name. There are brown and blue-black clouds through bay windows, dim lawns as we pack our bags and leave our reticent guide to catch our trains home. I work out this poem, another multiple-choice exam, babysitting a small person. Her teeth crunch passion fruit seeds. I tell her, "Your mouth sounds like a concrete mixer." Poetry is our human love of metaphor. We see one thing and think of something else. A green wool dress becomes the woman we love. Poetry is non-local causality. We are bathed in a mysterious glow. That's why I write poetry.
Thank you, Geoffrey. I think that's a great spot to end on. So many thanks for coming back and talking about your latest book, Poems 1957 to 2013. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of that. I mean, without question, Geoffrey's one of Australia's finest poets, and we've seen an example of that tonight. So it's been an interest and a pleasure to have you here tonight, and no doubt you'll be back again in the future. But for tonight, congratulations on the latest volume, and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.